The Tom Woods Show, episode 1525.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Today, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to share with you the short talk I gave at the Mises Institute Supporters Summit in Los Angeles last weekend on Mises and destructionism. If you read Socialism by Mises, which I'm ashamed to say I had not done until quite recently, he has a section on something he calls destructionism. So you'll find out what that is in a minute, but I'm sure you can tell it's not a good thing. So I talk about how that applies to our current situation, and I hope you enjoy that. But then after that's over, as I said, it's probably about 20 minutes, and I would feel bad giving you just a 20-minute episode. So I have a few more things to tell you after that is all over. So do not switch to some other program hosted by some other libertarian. No. You just hang on for a minute. I got a little bit more to tell you after this recording, which I hope you enjoy. Here we go.
Our next guest, most of you already know, Tom Woods. What can you say about Tom? He's a podcaster, an author, an intellectual of great renown, also host of a cruise in the fall of every year, holds degrees from Columbia and Harvard, yet was able to overcome those infirmities and be with us today. Tom Woods.
All right. Peter Klein was saying that some people have said that we should call it the Rothbard Institute, but one way you know this is not the Rothbard Institute is there is no way we would have started an event with an 8:30 in the morning breakfast when a Rothbard Institute, no way. You'd be doing it without Rothbard, that's for sure. Michael actually reminded me just now in his talk of one of my great memories with him years ago, probably early part of this decade. He and I were speaking at some kind of a Tea Party event. We were the only two real speakers at it in Topeka, Kansas. Having lived in Topeka, Kansas in my previous life for 6 years, I can tell you that is not Ron Paul country. It's either progressivism or Mike Huckabee. There's nothing else. No third position to be found there. It's those two and those two only. But these folks wanted us to come talk about the 10th Amendment and nullification because it was the Obama years, and so you're allowed to be against the federal government in those years, according to these people. And I thought, what the heck? I'm glad to talk to any audience whatsoever. So Michael gets up and gives a talk similar to the one he gave now, but in which he posed it as a thought experiment. Because at that time, people were worried about increasing federal gun regulations. And the thought experiment was, imagine if the gun owners, in defiance of federal regulations, continued to do X and Y and Z. And suppose they defied them to this extent that this number of states declared that they would never allow the enforcement of whatever, and everybody's cheering and saying, yeah, that would be great. And Michael says, well, you know what? That kind of defiance is going on right now, except not with guns, but with weed. And everybody's in their seats squirming, like, oh, no, we're wimpier than the weed people. But they loved Michael. They loved his arguments. They loved his decentralism. They loved the whole thing. And Michael sat down after that, and I think pretty satisfied with himself. I think he thought, there's no way Woods is going to one-up me on this one. I'm like, I've really stuck it to these people. And I said to him, you ain't seen nothing. I'm going to go tell them they shouldn't have said the Pledge of Allegiance at the beginning of this event. All right, I don't have that much time, partly because Michael went a little bit over, but I'm going to claim my full 20 minutes here. And I want to reflect a little bit on Mises' book, Socialism, published in 1922. And a later edition has an introduction by F.A. Hayek that begins as follows. When socialism first appeared in 1922, its impact was profound. It gradually but fundamentally altered the outlook of many of the young idealists returning to their university studies after World War I. I know, for I was one of them. We felt that the civilization in which we had grown up had collapsed. We were determined to build a better world, and it was this desire to reconstruct society that led many of us to the study of economics. Socialism promised to fulfill our hopes for a more rational, more just world. And then came this book. Our hopes were dashed. Socialism told us that we had been looking for improvement in the wrong direction. The central argument of Mises is the importance of private property in the means of production. And of course, that is the primary argument in his 1920 essay, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, that in the absence of private property in the means of production, there's no price formation and therefore no economic calculation, no profit and loss accounting, so no way to know that resources are being allocated rationally, and no way for various industries even to be able to pull resources toward them that they need more urgently than other industries do. You're operating completely in the dark because you have no way to compare incommensurable goods. How do you compare lumber and rubber in the absence of prices? So you have industries that could just as easily get by with this resource rather than that, but they're using this one because it's all arbitrary, and these other industries that more urgently need that one don't have it. It's absolute chaos. So you need private property in the means of production. And it turns out that we all benefit from there being private property in the means of production, even if we individually own no means of production. I benefit from the fact that other people own the means of production. So when Hayek says we were looking for a way to create a better world, this is the way, private property and the means of production. Take, for example, the 19th century in the United States. What's the trend in prices, consumer prices in the 19th century in peacetime? All downward. Prices are falling consistently throughout the 19th century. Now, I know we're told that that's terrible and this leads to terrible economic outcomes, but to the contrary, we saw the emergence of the greatest economic superpower of all time in the transition from the late 19th into the early 20th centuries under the conditions of falling prices. We don't have the falling prices anymore, except in certain sectors of the economy, because we have a Federal Reserve that keeps pumping up the money supply. But if we didn't have that, you would still continue to see, and in some cases, prices do fall. Even nominally, we still see them falling, particularly in electronics, for example. But what that means, well, what is the meaning of falling prices over time? It is capitalism, in effect, working out its destiny. That is, the destiny of conquering scarcity. Things become less and less dear in a capitalist economic order because we have more and more capital investment in equipment that is able to produce more goods at lower prices, and that puts downward pressure on consumer prices, and we're able to buy more things with our consistent paycheck. And so capitalism is taking us closer and closer to a world of zero price, a world we can never reach, but which we can approach asymptotically. So for example, take this pen. Maybe this kind of pen costs you $2 in the store. So you may say to me, Woods, I don't see how I benefit from other people owning the means of production. I still have to pay for the pen. But think of it this way. Imagine you had to produce this pen from scratch. You have to do the research into learning about ink. You have to generate all the individual parts. You have to have a plant that assembles them. You have to interview workers. You need oil to get gasoline for the vehicles that are going to transport the various parts. Imagine the price the pen would cost you millions of dollars. So $2 may as well be zero. Or likewise, even when you're looking at, let's say, I just saw the other day, a 65-inch flat screen TV for $449. And you say, Woods, how am I benefiting from other people owning the means of production? I still have to pay for the TV. Imagine you creating that TV from scratch. You got to do all the research and development, so you got to hire scientists. I mean, imagine every single stage of production you have to do. $449 compared to what that's going to cost you may as well be zero. We all benefit from living in this social and economic order, but we don't stop to appreciate it because we're not taught to do so. Mises uses an interesting word in socialism, and that is the word destructionism. He's so great with some of these words he comes up with. I love this. He says, socialism is not in the least what it pretends to be. It is not the pioneer of a better and finer world, but the spoiler of what thousands of years of civilization have created. It does not build, it destroys. For destruction is the essence of it. It produces nothing. It only consumes what the social order based on private ownership in the means of production has created. And then he goes on to say that this policy of destructionism means the consumption of capital. We have people in the United States today, people who are taken very seriously, who think that billionaires are people who have $1 billion that they just roll around in until it sticks to their sweaty bodies. They have no idea what this $1 billion is actually doing, or where it is, or the function that it plays. It can simply be confiscated, and we can spend it on things that we like. But that is simply capital consumption. That calls to mind Mises' example of somebody who tries to produce heat by burning his furniture. Yes, you will produce heat in the short run. That's true. You will. But you shouldn't deceive yourself into thinking that you've come up with a costless way, endlessly, of producing heat. And likewise for destroying capital, destroying the funds that maintain capital. And I'll get back to that in a few minutes. But I want to point out a really clear and obvious example of destructionism today at work. And that is the so-called Green New Deal. Now, we're all tired of hearing about this, but you're going to have to sit here for one more minute and listen. Because I had a fellow on my podcast, The Tom Woods Show, named Patrick Moore, who was one of the founders of Greenpeace. Now, today, the other founders of Greenpeace have desperately tried to scratch him off the founders list and claim he wasn't really one, but he was. They're just full of it. And he also headed Greenpeace Canada for a long time. So I had him on. He's kind of turned around in his thinking. And I said, well, tell me about the Green New Deal and what your opinion of it is. Because I said, I know you had a pithy response to it on Twitter. Here was what he said. Well, my pithy response was that it would cause an immediate collapse of the agricultural system if it was adopted worldwide and would result immediately, beginning in the center of the large metropolises, in starvation and death and cannibalism, no doubt, as it spread outwards, to end up with only a few subsistence farmers surviving in the wild. So that's my take on it if we just instantly implemented it, which is pretty quick. 10 years is pretty much instantly. And then he continued, I tweeted out to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you pompous little twit, you don't have a plan to feed 8 billion people without using fossil fuels. There are these things called tractors, and there are these other things called semi-trailers that need to carry 40 tons of food at a time into the inner cities in all our metropolises, where there's not enough room to grow the food for the people in the 60-story high-rises. And without fossil fuels, this system would break down and immediately result in mass death. And in addition to that, if we quit fossil fuels tomorrow, there wouldn't be a tree left on this planet within a very short time. Is that the future we want for human civilization? To absolutely decimate the entire global environment for firewood to cook and heat our homes, which is what would happen with this many people. Now, what should we do about that? That's a separate question. And later in his discussion with me, he gives his answer. But what I want to do before I carry on is pause for a minute for a little audience participation time. No, don't worry. I'm not calling on anybody. But you know, we all carry these little devices around. And at an event like this, everybody tells you to silence them, turn them off, throw them in the garbage, whatever. I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to urge you to turn on your phone. And I'm going to give you something that I produced a little earlier this year. It's my AOC is Wrong ebook. I went through, thank you, every single, whether it's higher education, that should be free, or the Green New Deal, or the minimum wage, or Medicare for all, or more public housing, or whatever it is, this smashes to smithereens every one of these things. And I know in this room we think, yeah, we're against all those things. But if you're cornered by a progressive, are you really sure that you would have devastating arguments that would leave them intellectually limping away? Are you sure of that? Because if not, I got just the thing for you. And you can get it for free from your seat right now because of the technology capitalism developed. All you got to do is text a word to the number 33444. And I'm going to tell you what that word is to get this free ebook. It'll be emailed to you immediately. They'll get your email address from there. 33444, you just put the word, make it all one word, wrong AOC. wrong AOC, AOC Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You just text wrong AOC, all one word, to 33444, and you'll get that free thing. You're going to love that. All right, so let's get back to this. I look at that Green New Deal, and I wonder if really the situation is that dire and urgent, why is two-thirds of this plan about social justice goals that they want to reach? If the world is going to end, I would say, you know, social justice is very important, but the survival of the human race is even more important. So I wouldn't be saying, when we retrofit every building in America, it's important that at least 50% of the construction workers be Asian women or whatever. Who in his right mind would say that at a time like that? Look, we'll get Asian women into construction jobs once we save the planet. But right now, the urgent thing is that we not all die. Like, wouldn't you think they'd talk like that? That's why I don't believe them. Also, they lie about everything, so why would I believe them about this one thing? But also, before I started talking to Patrick Moore, I looked up what Greenpeace had to say about nuclear power, because I figured, you know, this kind of solves the problem. What do they say about nuclear power? They describe nuclear power as a distraction from the real solutions to climate change. And I found that so revealing. They call it a distraction. Well, I mean, it can solve a lot of our problems without all the dislocation and revolutionary change. But if the point of what you're doing is dislocation and revolutionary change, then yes, nuclear power would be a distraction from that. Now, the other example of destructionism I want to give, and here I will trespass a bit into the extra time that I'm getting from Michael Bolden, is this. When I go on Twitter and social media, and I look at how the average voter who's voting for redistribution schemes justifies it, that average voter justifies it on the grounds that consumption is what makes the economy go. And if all these rich people are just rolling around in their money and it's not doing anything, this brings the economy down. Whereas if you give money to the average Joe, he goes to the store and buys things. And after all, isn't that what the economy is all about? Us going to the store and buying things? Okay, now, I mean, I can understand why people would think that. Superficially, it does seem like that's what the economy is. Dollar bills changing hands from one to another. But let's do a little thought experiment about this. Consumption is all we need to care about thing. Okay, consumption is where it's at. Let's stimulate consumption. Consumption, consumption, consumption. All right. Suppose we have an unskilled laborer who was not driven out of a job by the $15 minimum wage. Okay, this is a lucky guy. All right, he's still working. All right. And suppose he's now earning $15 an hour, gets all this extra income. And suppose that we are so interested in fostering consumption that we establish a new rule. No doing anything with your paycheck except spending it on consumer goods. That'll get the economy moving, right? Those stupid rich people just save their money, but this working man will spend it, and that will help us. So here's what happens. So the worker goes with his money, some of his extra pay, and he buys 5 gallons of milk with it. And then the person selling him the milk takes the money and buys a new shirt. And the person selling the shirt takes the money and buys a few gallons of gas. And so on. Nothing is saved. Nothing is productively expended. Nothing's invested. Everything is consumed. Well, this would be great, right? Well, here's what this actually means. No wages will get paid because wages is not consumption. Paying wages is not consumption. So there'd be no payroll. No business-related bills would be paid because that's not consumption. No intermediate goods would be ordered by later stage production, because that's not consumption either. And capital goods, things like assembly line equipment or tractors or forklifts or steam shovels or whatever, all these things that make the economy more productive, they would not be purchased because that's not consumption. Those are not consumer goods. They're not used by consumers. And then the existing capital goods that we have would wear out. They would not be replaced because that's not consumption. So the result of all this spending on consumer goods and doing nothing else would be we would just run out of consumer goods. And then all the gross saving that's necessary to keep the structure of production going, not having occurred, the productive capacity of the economy collapses. And we revert to barbarism. That's your utopia of consumption. So it turns out that rich people don't, in fact, just sit on their money or hide their money or roll around in their money. These are the people whose savings maintain and expand the capital structure, which is the array of goods that combine to produce the consumer goods we need. And without these, we would return to a hand-to-mouth existence. That's destructionism. is the demonization of the wealthy, refusing to acknowledge that they perform any role at all, and thinking instead that all we need is to hand money to ordinary people, and if those green pieces of paper just move from one pair of hands to another, we'll have prosperity. We will have a capital-free economy in a matter of, I don't know how many years, not very long. And that would be destructionism on the worst possible scale. So yes, the economy is more than just money passing from hand to hand in exchange for consumer goods. So today, it seems to me we have a fairly easy task ahead of us because we don't have to argue really complicated things. We just have to argue in favor of civilization itself because our opponents really, really don't seem to like it. Or they like it so little that they can't be bothered to learn enough about what sustains it to favor those things. So this is the fight we are in. This is not an exaggeration. In no way am I being melodramatic. We are the forces of civilization against the modern day destructionists. And I tend to think that on balance, most people, when this matter becomes clear to them, will favor civilization over destructionism. This is the fight of our time, and I cannot think of a group of people I would rather work with in this fight than the Mises Institute and its wonderful supporters, whom I appreciate so much. Thank you.
All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed that. Now, as I say, I have another topic that I want to hit on. And before I do that, I want to remind you that chances are you are like me in that, especially because Woods has always given you more books to read. I got all these authors on, and that's where this extremely valuable app called Blinkist comes in. It's the only app that takes the key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, condenses them down into 15 minutes. You can read or listen to them that way. 8 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library. I like it because I can go on just a regular drive, half an hour each way, and in principle have consumed 4 books. And driving around is when I use it the most. Half the time I'm dropping my girls off somewhere, and then it's just me in the car. What am I going to do? So I use Blinkist to make sure I make the most of the time. Blinkist, by the way, is how I finally read The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. When I had him on The Peter Schiff Show, I was just bluffing, I'll be honest with you. And I've also appreciated Getting Things Done by David Allen. Well, right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Woods to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Woods to start your free 7-day trial. Blinkist.com/Woods. All right, folks, so continuing on with episode 1525, I sent out an email to my list today about something I just saw on YouTube. It was an episode of the Jimmy Dore show. This is a great guy. I'd love to get this guy on the program. I don't know how I would do that, but I'd love to get him on. He's one of these people on the left that I can actually respect because he says things that, sure, he's able to build an audience with, but that are not going to make him popular with a lot of the mainstream left. And even some of the hard left is just not going to go for his content and style. But he's somebody who, for example, will watch David Stockman, whom you know from this program, Ronald Reagan's budget director, on Fox Business and say, wow, Stockman did a great job. Even though he's a Reaganite, he did a great job and he stood up against these harpies who are shouting at him because he has unconventional views. I appreciate and respect that. So Dore is really, really great on the warfare state and how bad the Democrats are. And he'll even admit once in a while when somebody to the right of him is pretty darn good on the subject. So what I'm going to do, because I'd like you to see this thing, by the way, and now, of course, the best way to see it is to get on my list. I have tried everything. I've given away every ebook top. Oh, by the way, I have another one coming out soon. I got to finish that baby. I hope by next week we'll get that thing out to you, The Pentagon versus the Economy. I'll get that out to you. But anyway, head over to, let's see, AOCiswrong.com. That's a good ebook, and that gets you on my list. But anyway, I'm going to link at tomwoods.com/1525 to this video. And what it is, it's Jimmy Dore analyzing a clip from Maria Bartiromo's program on Fox Business, featuring David Stockman as a guest, along with the 4 panelists. 3 of the 4 panelists speak during the clip. And all of them are against Stockman. I'm sure the fourth one is as well. And he's just effortlessly parrying them because all they have, the bizarre thing about it, all they have is talking points. Because what Stockman is saying is that we have to cut spending, which they're okay with that. We have to cut, as long as it's unspecified spending, they're all in favor in principle of cutting spending. When there are actual cuts proposed, they're against all of them, naturally. But it's legitimate to be on Maria Bartiromo's program and say you want to cut spending. So she says, but what about the military? And he says, yeah, of course, obviously we need to cut the military. The increases in the Pentagon budget have been ridiculous. I mean, 40% since the height of the Iraq war. This is absurd. This is just a racket. And she pounces on him. And she uses the regime-approved word starved. This is the official word of the regime to refer to the military. Don't you know the military has been starved? So that's what you'll hear on all right-wing talk radio. You'll see it in right-wing blogs. The military has been starved. It's a word. It's like they all got together and said, we're going to use the word starved to refer to this. So she's going with the word starved. Now, yeah, obviously people who grow rich from the Pentagon's racket, they say it's been starved. And apparently that's good enough for her. By no means has it been starved. Compare the U.S. military budget to that of the entire rest of the world or the next 50 countries put together or whatever. And it's comparable. And that's starved, according to her. Meanwhile, in the maybe 9 or 10 years after 9/11, there was a $2 trillion increase in Pentagon spending over and above the baseline. There was a $2 trillion increase. And half of that went to pay for the wars, but the other half nobody quite knows what happened to. Because if you look at the Army, well, it had like a 7% increase, even though the spending on it was enormously inflated. We saw the number of in certain categories of naval ships go down. In all these different categories, they had more money to spend and less to show for it. And her solution is more money to spend. Now, she would not accept that if it were education or any other area where they get a lot of money and they have zero to show for it. She'd say, well, why would we reward this? Exactly. But if you're David Stockman on Fox Business, you are to be ridiculed and condemned. Then there's a woman, I don't even know who she is. I don't want to know who she is. She's sitting there with her arms folded the whole time. She can't believe she has to sit here and listen to talking points that have not been approved by the New York Times or National Review or whatever, you know, the spectrum of opinion. She cannot believe somebody with unapproved opinions is here talking to her, suggesting that there may be liars inside the U.S. government because Stockman doesn't believe the official story of half these interventions. And she can't believe that. I know Colonel so-and-so who's over here and you could talk to him about it all being a hoax. Like that's an argument. And as Jimmy Dore says, it's like she's personally offended by this. She's just a person. Like, what does this have to do with anything? Why is she so upset about it? And so Stockman just continues to stand his ground. She has no, I mean, you think I'm making this up? Watch this woman. She's the one on the far left of the screen. She just continues on. She has no evidence, no arguments, no facts whatsoever. Her outrage alone at having to endure unapproved opinions is supposed to be enough to make us change our minds. And yet there are some of us who think that her mere ex-cathedra opinion is not quite enough to make us rethink our positions. So it's worth watching. So again, tomwoods.com/1525. I insist you go over there and watch this. And I don't insist on too many things. I'm insisting on this. There are three reasons that you need to see it. First, it's great to see David Stockman standing his ground. Now, it's tremendous because I think David is better now than he was when he was in the Reagan administration. I think he's harder core. However, you should know that he was even anti-war as a Republican in the late 1970s when he first ran for Congress. Now, that was a lonely time. You had Ron Paul and you had nobody else. He was against the Vietnam War. So I remember when I asked him this, when did you become anti-war? He was always anti-war, even as a Republican. And they tried to use this against him in his congressional run in the 70s, and it didn't work. So it's not like he's gotten better on, I think he's gotten better on the Fed and he's gotten better on just his overall feelings about the regime. He's much, much more anti-establishment now than he was then. But the great thing about David is he's always been good on war, even when it would hurt him politically. He's never, ever been in favor of this stuff. So that's the first thing. To see somebody like David in action is refreshing for us and it's encouraging to us. Secondly, because I think it's interesting for you to see what Soviet state television must have been like, because it would have been just like this, just empty slogans and talking points, except on Soviet state television, there wouldn't have been a David Stockman, or he would have been executed afterward. And then thirdly, you just got to hear this commentary by Jimmy Dore. I had somebody write to me and say, I could have used without the Jimmy Dore portion. I disagree completely. I was laughing out loud. I loved this guy. He was just great talking about the absurdities of the people on the panel. So you're definitely going to appreciate it. So I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1525. I also have it's not a very good shortcut, but a little shortcut. tomwoods.com/Stockman Hysteria takes you directly to the video. tomwoods.com/Stockman Hysteria. So that is that for today. Okay, now you think, let's see, I worked 10 minutes today and I'm exhausted, so I got to get going. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.